Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Well, would you like the good news or the bad news first? All right, let's go bad news, good news. Okay, yeah. Bad news, you know how annoying it is when your sleeping partner snores? Well, turns out that snorting and gasping and super disturbing sound that gets worse the older you get is not just interfering with both of you having a good restful sleep. Snoring, it's now been shown in a study, could be yet another way that dementia is going to catch up with you. Yep. Research by the University of Sydney reveals obstructive sleep apnea, often the reason that people are snoring, has a clear link with dementia. It's the first time a direct link of this kind has been shown. More bad news, a lot of people don't have a partner to kick them when they start snoring, so they have no idea they snore. Good news, if you screen people for sleep apnea and treat them, then you could be helping to prevent dementia. The leader of the study is Professor Sharon Naismith of the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre. And the interesting thing about this discovery is that it came from studies of memory loss, not sleep loss.
Yeah, well, at the University of Sydney, we have a specialist clinic which is open to people who have any new concerns about their memory or thinking problems, and people from the age of 50. And the reason why we do that is because we know that most of the changes that are occurring in the brain occur about 10 to 20 years before dementia onset. So this is really the time where we can look at very, very early changes in memory and other thinking functions and try to unravel what are the key factors that are contributing to those changes in the brain.
Would that appear different to the person or to their relatives than just the normal sort of stress-related, busyness-related, forgetting someone's phone number or forgetting the name of someone whose face you know well?
Yeah, look, it's a good question, Stephen. It's very hard to disentangle in the early stages. But look, the general kind of benchmark that we would say is, do other people your age have similar problems or changes in their memory? And if the answer is yes, then we'd say I wouldn't be too concerned about them. But if they are to the point where it's much more significant changes or difficulty even with higher level thinking like problem solving and planning and decision making and
that kind of thing.
Then we'd start to get a bit more concerned.
All right. Well, let's go a little bit deeper. So here you are investigating these 83 people of a range of ages in their 50s, 60s, 70s into their 80s, and you started to notice something else was going on.
Yeah, well, we've been really interested in sleep, Stephen, because there's been some seminal discoveries in the last 5 years that show that sleep is really important for clearing these toxins in the brain while we're sleeping. So it's a bit like a sewage system or a plumbing system for the brain. So we go to sleep. That's right. It sounds a bit crazy, but it's actually amazing. Our brain is very well developed in terms of getting rid of these toxins. And what happens is they build up in the daytime and then at night time they all clear out.
Right.
So there have been some really good studies linking, you know, these pathological proteins of dementia with disturbances of sleep. So it's a major focus of a lot of our research.
And just to be clear, the proteins themselves, the toxins you're talking about are chemical substances. They're proteins of some sort. You're not talking about electrical activity, as it were.
No, we're talking about beta amyloid, which is the key protein in Alzheimer's, and also tau, the other two key proteins that are involved in Alzheimer's disease, and they are key things that are cleared out with the process of sleep.
Now, do they clear out with any sleep, or does it have to be deep REM-type sleep?
The slow wave sleep, where we're really kind of out to it, the one that's really hard to wake us up from, seems to be the most beneficial for clearing out those proteins. But it's very early days. We've got a lot more work to do to think about how can we speed up this process of clearance? How can we actually make it better?
All right, so you're investigating those people. You started to see that these beta amyloids were not clearing out of their brains. And then these were people, I gather, who had not previously reported sleep problems.
Yeah, well, the key focus of the paper we just published was actually about oxygen desaturation. But these are people that had not reported sleep problems necessarily. They came along to the clinic because they were concerned about their memory. And we have a centre of research excellence where we're really focused on sleep. And so we did these very detailed overnight sleep studies. And we also did brain scans. So it's very rare that most of these disciplines have tended to either focus on the brain or focus on the sleep, but not marry the two together. So this is what we did in this study, which makes it so unique. And we found actually that it was sleep apnea, this process where we are starving our brain of oxygen during sleep, that seemed to be most detrimental and was highly linked to the shrinkage of the brain in these temporal lobes, which are the bits that control our memories.
So any sleep apnea, or in particular obstructive sleep apnea?
Yeah, so it's obstructive sleep apnea. And it's really not just about the severity of the apnea. So apnea is usually defined by what we call an apnea hypopnea index, which is how many times you completely stop breathing or partially stop breathing during sleep. And so what that actually does is it fragments our sleep. We wake up a lot because of the need to kind of gasp for air. But we also, our oxygen levels also dip if we're having one of these apneas or hypopneas. So this was the key thing, really, that it's not just about the severity overall. It's about how much of oxygen desaturation we have in our blood and therefore, you know, by inference, also our brain.
Yeah, so why does that link particularly to this type of apnea called obstructive sleep apnea, which is where the throat sort of closes and opens, causing the obstruction that then in turn makes your oxygen dip and then in turn wakes you up? Why was that in particular linked to the effect that you were showing of brain shrinkage? Sounds very horrible.
Yeah, it's a good question. We're not entirely sure. Some of our other research has shown that apnea is also related to the antioxidant levels in the brain. So there's probably some very complex dynamics going on that we haven't entirely unravelled. So Right. Now what we need to work out, we know that hypoxia, which is when we starve our brain cells of oxygen, is certainly linked to brain damage. There's been studies over many decades showing that. But this one shows, you know, more conclusively in these older people that this is a key factor. The key now is to kind of try and unravel, I guess, you know, when are these oxygen desaturations occurring, what exactly is happening at a cellular mechanism, and how is this contributing to the formation of this beta amyloid, and how does it link to this other kind of plumbing system of the brain?
Our guest on Open House is Professor Sharon Naismith from the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre, and their paper has just been published in the European Respiratory Journal. It's the first paper that's really linked sleep apnea with brain degeneration, leading potentially to dementia. Sharon, how concerned should people be about that?
Look, I mean, the most important thing is actually that there is a treatment for it. So if people have concerns about their sleep or about their memory, really important to speak to your doctor. It may turn out that it's nothing and it's just part of normal aging, but people usually know. People usually know if these are more than just normal changes, or if their sleep has changed, or they're excessively sleepy. And so we do have gold standard treatments for sleep apnea. The key thing is about dementia, to get in early. We have no cures for dementia, so prevention is absolutely critical. And thinking about these things in midlife is really important. So about 8% of Australian men probably have significant sleep apnea. And there are risk factors: older age, being male, having being obese or having a higher body mass index, drinking alcohol and taking sedatives. So important, you know, if someone's having those concerns, to think about those things. But, you know, not to get too concerned without speaking to a doctor and having these things investigated.
But is that to say that the people who do have sleep apnea and are being treated for it, or especially those who are not being treated for it, are you saying that there's a causation, or have you just seen a correlation? In other words, will they all have brain shrinkage leading to dementia, or is there just something that you want to investigate that correlates those two things?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. My as a scientist, my my approach or my response would always be to say we can only ever say it's a correlation. However, from the sleep apnea literature more generally, we know that there's we feel much more confident that there's causation involved here, because the sleep apnea literature from middle-aged men and middle-aged samples predominantly also is showing this risk. And there's also been a what we call a meta-analysis, so we put all the large-scale studies together that have followed people up longitudinally.
Yes.
And that was published last year and showed that sleep apnea, that if you have sleep apnea in midlife, there's about a 26% increased chance of progressing to dementia.
So what percentage of people in your study then who had sleep apnea turned out to show changes to their temporal lobes?
Yeah, we can't say that for sure because it was all done on a group level.
I see.
So we didn't look at individual people. And what we would like to do now is certainly increase the size of the sample and follow people longitudinally, and then we'll be able to answer those kind of questions at an individual level, much more. But I think what an individual can take away from it is if they're having a sleep study and their oxygen is dipping at night time, particularly if it's dipping below 90%, then that's more reason to be concerned.
Now, which leads me to our last question. Now, because you've come at this from the point of view of brain studies, people who've come to you with brain dysfunction or concerns about memory, you've tracked backwards to a potential causation in sleep apnea. Should those people looking at sleep apnea, who are largely sleep specialists, lung doctors, as I understand it, should they be sending serious cases off for a brain scan now as a matter of course?
Yeah, look, I think that's an excellent question, because the tests that are typically done in those kind of medical settings are very gross tests. You need to have dementia, really, to fail those kind of tests that are done. So we are very keen to, advocate for people to have more detailed testing. And certainly the studies using detailed neuropsychology, which can take 2 or 3 hours of someone's time, actually probes things like memory and thinking speed and problem solving and all of those higher level thinking skills. It probes those functions much more deeply. So that can't be done on a bedside kind of test. And certainly, someone can have hundreds of apneas per hour, and there's good evidence that those people have cognitive impairment. So the key thing really is to, use the treatment that's available, because it does work, but also get memory and other functions tested if you're concerned, and, for sleep doctors to refer people off for those tests.
And the brain scan option, I mean, that's a pretty, that would be going a long way to have MRI, but that would definitely show changes, wouldn't it?
The brain scan could show changes. Sometimes we don't see those changes until it's too late.
Oh, I see.
So the testing is much more sensitive. Yeah. The brain scan changes in those areas of the brain is very hard to eyeball. We were able to see it at a group kind of level, but a radiologist looking at a scan like that and trying to look for these changes in the temporal lobe would be a bit more problematic until someone was more advanced in terms of their decline.
Well, that is fascinating, and I suppose not the least bit concerning for a sizable proportion of the population that falls into that danger zone and those who care for them. Just one final thing. You're the chief investigator of a new thing, the Australian Dementia Network. That's interesting.
Right.
How far do you think we are away from really understanding dementia?
I think we are still a long way away from understanding dementia. We've had decades of research looking for cures for dementia that haven't worked. So we are hopeful, with the network that we will have a cohort of people, ready that we can trial new therapies. But I really don't see anything, in the next 10 years or so that will actually be, able to cure dementia without significant trials. So we're a bit of a way off now, but we really need to focus with the network on, trialing new treatments that are available, but also improving the quality of life of people that are already suffering from dementia. And providing support for their families, improving better access to care, diagnostics and that kind of thing as well. And really focusing on these early intervention agendas as well, looking for the major risk factors. So we know, Stephen, that about 50% of the risk of dementia is due to things that are modifiable. the general population doesn't know that. So we really need to get that out there, you know, not only sleep, which is kind of the new exciting and emerging risk factor, but actually it's exciting for me as a researcher.
You're so exciting, like that's a good thing.
But the depression, you know, accounts for about 8% of dementia risk, and
really?
The physical inactivity,
goodness,
not keeping our brains active enough, and heart disease and cardiovascular disease as well. So all of those things together account for between 30 to 50% of risk. So it's just enormous. We really need to be starting to tackle those things, you know, before it's too late.
Well, I can't say it's been fun. I mean, well, it's been enjoyable and instructive speaking with you, Sharon, and I'm really glad we've had this talk.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Professor Sharon Naismith from the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre, a world-first study with a correlation, if not necessarily a causality, but a correlation between sleep apnea, serious sleep apnea, and signs of dementia. Her advice is it's both arresting and also important. There's no cure for dementia, so get yourself checked out for a sleep problem and treat the sleep problem, because that's one thing you can treat. And if sleep problems hasten or lead to dementia, then you want to get onto that as soon as possible.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.